Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's time for another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. I'm David Summers, and here comes the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, one thing I know about you is you like to keep up with your listeners, fans on social media, and there's a problem with one of your social media accounts. You're not able to communicate. I think it's Facebook that's not working right for you. What's going on?
Jeez, man. You know, I'm about to get it fixed today, Dave. I'm not too good on my computer, but I got a gentleman that is. And so, thanks for bringing it up. I'd like for everybody to know that that I'm still going to be on Facebook, but I haven't been able to get on myself. And so we're going to get that taken care of today, hopefully. And so if you've been trying to get in touch with me and you're wondering what's going on Facebook, all three of my Facebook sites have been, I can't get on them. Fans are going to get on them, but I can't get on them.
Yeah.
But we'll get that squared away today.
I have one Facebook site nobody wants to be on at all. At all. You have three people clamoring to talk to you. All right, Stud, here we go. This is Studcast number 375, Ron. It's kind of another milestone. More than 7 years of you talking about professional wrestling history, mostly from your own experience, but starting with your grandfather's choice of lifestyle, and his history more than 100 years ago. So fans around the world really do rave about this show. Studcasts have become a way of life for a lot of them. And when these studcasts come in, it's like, boom, here comes another one. And they start carving out time to have an opportunity to listen to it back. I think that's really cool.
Well, it's kind of become a way of life for me too, Dave. No, I spend at least, say, 3 to 8 hours a day doing research on each episode, sometimes 3 days a week, preparing the details for each one of them and getting the information from several different sources that I now have, thank goodness, that I couldn't do without. And I want to thank all those people out there for what they do to make my studcast so special.
Well, you're right in the middle of diving even deeper into these studcasts, plus creating what I've been told will be one of the most colossal and comprehensive streaming channels ever done. How's that going?
Wow, man. It's going to be something special, that's for sure. And, you know, we've added a lot of new content to this one and never before stuff that we've ever put on before. We've been working on this, Dave, for 2 weeks. Stuff's going on it every day. And it's also going to include almost everything wrestling related that I have ever recorded over the last 7 years. And I'm adding to that figure every day. Another studcast today, number 375, as a matter of fact. And so this new streaming channel will have every studcast I have ever done, 375 of them, as of today, and every one of them is going to be in chronological order, just as they were recorded. That's over 400 hours of studcast alone.
Wow.
It's going to also include hundreds of hours of original Southeastern, Continental, and USA TV shows, all produced by me and my companies between 1980 and 1988. And there'll be hours of other content there as well. I have these tributes to the fallen stars that were all very close friends of mine, like Andre the Giant, Terry Funk, Bobby Shane, Adrian Street, and just lately Kevin Sullivan, and got countless hours of stud stories, including my assessment of 9 former NWA world champions, plus many more famous stars, 23 stud cast archives, loaded with wrestling history, and so much more, man.
Yeah, some of those I remember specifically that I recorded with you, where you're recounting about wrestling some of these former champions, and they are definitely memorable. I mean, so memorable that I think they're definitely something that you want to check out. It's been a while, so I need to loop back and check some of those out again. So really, it's no wonder that people are already saying this is going to be the best wrestling streaming channel on the planet. Do you have any idea how much content will eventually be on this streaming channel and when it's going to be available to fans?
Well, my best guess about how much content is going to be there is I believe it's going to be somewhere over 1,000 hours. So, and when we get it all on there,
wow,
I'll probably announce the premiere date early next month in December. And I don't want to get to more than 200 hours on it before it becomes available to fans. So, and I think we're going to be well over that figure before they're able to even start to take a look at it.
Yeah, I got you. I mean, and over 1,000 hours, when you talk about how hard you work, that is evidence right there of how stacked this thing is going to be, it certainly eventually is going to be with all the work that you've done. I mean, absolutely amazing. So if when you try to subscribe to it, you would probably never be able to see it all. So I could talk about that all day, but we've got another studcast to add to the list. Are you ready to do that? And if so, where are we going to be riding this week, stud?
We're going to get right into it, man. But as I said on the last episode, the studcast following this one will be that long-awaited opening night for Birmingham, Alabama. Its debut in the growing Southeastern Wrestling Company. And in this episode, I'm going to give Southeast Stud Coast fans a short history of Birmingham as a wrestling city. And we're going to talk about how the ticket sales were going and other discussions with the Boutwell Auditorium manager that I had become good friends with at this point. And we're going to be introducing Roy Lee Welch to him as well as the new representative for my company. So we'll briefly discuss meetings Roy Lee and I had with both Birmingham TV stations and the Boutwell Auditorium manager. And we'll be talking about the final preparations to open a new Southeastern city. Not just any market this time, but the biggest city in Southeastern history. Then we're going to ride south, man, down to Pensacola, the home of Southeastern Gulf Coast. And we'll get into today's studcast information. We'll be talking about the next card for Southeastern, which is going to be in the first week of November 1980, and what was on the TV show, the results of that card, and for the last time, we'll talk about the attendances in the three major markets, because next studcast, we're going to be in a fourth market as we start to talk about Birmingham and what happens on this opening night in Birmingham. Then given enough time, maybe we'll even have enough time for another learning tree, man.
Hey, that would be awesome. Sounds like Birmingham was about to change everything for Southeastern. All right, you said we could get a short history lesson about Birmingham wrestling. I always enjoy hearing something about the history of the sport. What do you got for us?
Well, according to the history I've studied, and it's quite a bit about my grandfather, Roy, especially as it concerned Birmingham. And he brought the first regular wrestling matches to Birmingham in the early 1930s. And soon after arriving in Tennessee, after beginning his wrestling career in Ohio, he was followed there by three great wrestlers, Danny Dusick, Pat Malone, and Charlie Carr. All were friends of his, and he had met all of them while wrestling in Ohio, and they all wanted to go with him to accomplish his goal of establishing one of the largest territories ever. So he was also joined by Jack and Herb, two of his three brothers that he had personally trained. Roy's territory was spreading out so fast across the Deep South in the late 1930s, and it included major cities like Nashville, Memphis, Chattanooga, and Birmingham. He was really focusing on the big cities, obviously. And it was in this city of Birmingham that Roy found what he needed most at that time, and that was somebody to handle the business side of the company while Roy handled the wrestlers and what happened in the ring. Nick Gulas was that man. And most fans, especially if they're from the South in the Tennessee area and all surrounding that state of Tennessee, will recognize that name. Nick was an very energetic young fan, man, started out putting up wrestling posters in Birmingham. And a few years later, he was selected by Roy as his partner to help run the business side of the company. Nick was a sharp businessman, obviously, or Roy would have never picked him. But in the very early years of their partnership, Roy made the mistake of putting Nick into spots where he had to sometimes ride with the wrestlers from town to town, especially out of Birmingham when they were going to be around Birmingham close. And it was before those wrestlers knew what his position was in the company and what that he was going to eventually be one of the owners. So to those wrestlers, Nick got no respect at this point when he was very young. And that was a fact that Roy wasn't aware of. I don't think Roy even knew how the wrestlers were treating him. And especially that the wrestlers would often take Nick and make him lay in the back floorboard of their cars, and they would put their feet on him traveled down from one city to another. And Nick was going to handle a box office, and then they would get back in the floorboard, and they'd put their feet on him going home.
Oh, God. Wow. I mean, wait. You said the wrestlers would put him in the floorboard of the back seat and then rest their feet on him on the way to and from matches.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said, Dave. Hard to believe, right?
Yeah, I heard that.
So obviously, man, when Nick got in more powerful and he moved to Nashville and he began to spend all of his time then in the wrestling office there, where Roy's wrestling office was in Nashville. And one of Nick's primary jobs was to figure out the payoff for the wrestlers in the territory, right? So it opened the door for him to get his revenge, man, against a lot of these wrestlers that had done these horrible, that would put their feet on him for time after time. He had his opportunity because he was making the payoff to cheat guys out of the money that they had earned. So it was such a bad arrangement that over the years ahead, it dramatically affected Roy's entire territory. And it gave the company a bad reputation for having horrible payoffs. So as Roy grew older and less in control of the business side of things, it eventually led to the downfall of the company itself. And it certainly didn't help that Nick made his son, George Gulas, who was a horrible wrestler, the champion of the territory. So by the late 1970s, Roy was already gone and out of it. Nick was selling off pieces of the old territory that my grandfather had created. Mm. And that's how Southeastern got control. And that's how we got control of Birmingham and all of northern Alabama.
Wow. Okay. All right. So I'm with you. So, I mean, and real wrestling history right there, plus a story I've never heard, especially the part about wrestlers putting their feet on Nick Gulas in the back floorboard of their cars. That history lesson has brought us back to opening Birmingham. So what can you tell us about your cousin, Roy Lee Welch, and why did you take him to Birmingham with you? What was that about?
Well, I always thought, man, it was the kiss of death for fans to find out that I owned any of the wrestling companies, and some of them I owned entirely. These are the companies that I created. And Roy Lee was already in charge of ticket sales and other promotional business. He was helping me in the office, basically. So it made sense for me to put him in charge of being the face of the company in Birmingham. So I picked him up. He lived in Pensacola, right where I was, and we rode together from Pensacola to Birmingham, and we had some extremely important meetings during this trip once we got there. I introduced Roy as the company's business manager to the Boutwell's auditorium's manager, and as it worked out on the visit with the manager, about 10 days before our first event there, more than half of the tickets for our first event had already been sold in advance. The manager told Roy and I that it was by far the biggest advance sale of that kind that he had ever had for a wrestling event. He had been there a lot of years, back into the late 1940s, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So it was good news and bad news.
Okay, I understand the part about it being good news, but how in any way could that be bad news?
Well, it meant that we were definitely going to sell out the entire building, good news, on opening night, but the normal walk-up fans were going to get there to buy a ticket. They were going to park their cars and try to get into the building, and they were going to find out that the building was sold out before they actually had the first walk-up. So, wow, that's a bad problem to have, but the really good part of it was that then he took us inside the arena, and it was my first opportunity to see the interior of Boutwell, and he showed us that, he said, here's the normal seating arrangement for wrestling, and as it had been set up, he said, for wrestling events there as long as he could remember, which was, way, way back. So there was only three rows of ringside around the ring to go with the 5,000 permanent seats there was in the three balconies in that building. So we talked him into adding more than 1,000 additional ringside seats on that huge arena main floor at $5 each. Before this first event. And then we convinced him that we wanted to make that the configuration for our new permanent seating arrangement with them for every one of the Southeastern Wrestling events. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were doing so good, obviously, to sell out in advance. We had to get more ringside seats, obviously. And he put as many as 1,000 seats on the floor besides those in that first three rows. So the next stop we went to was at both the TV stations. We were airing on two television stations at that time. And luckily, they were not aware of the tremendous advance sale of tickets already. And neither were we until we made this first stop at the Boutwell Auditorium. And we'd already made arrangements with both of these stations to buy spots to promote the show. But thankfully, after that Boutwell visit, we canceled those additional advertising because that would have been a waste of money for sure because the building was going to sell out, obviously. Yeah. So both TV stations were extremely impressed, man, with our TV shows. And they really, really were blown away by the improvement in the quality of our wrestlers that we had compared to what they had years before. Under Nick Gulas. They also said they already saw a significant jump in the July rating book, which had come out. We're close to November at this point. So they'd had a chance to see the new numbers, and they were really impressed that, wow, they're significantly higher than they had been. So they were really looking forward to this upcoming November rating book, which we are about to get into in this program here.
Yeah, okay, so that had to be kind of unexpected, I mean, but really good news. Those four rating books each year were critical to not only the TV stations, but to your company as well. So it sounds like Birmingham was really going to get off to a great start. All right. Are we riding south from here?
Yeah, man. I think we're going to go ahead and see if we can get down there to where Southeastern is doing business. And we're going to talk to everybody about the Southeastern card for the first week in November of 1980. Let's start out with the opening match, which was Roy Lee Welch. He was not just a manager, but he was a wrestler when need be. And he was back in the ring for a change. He wasn't wrestling a lot, but a little bit at the time. And he was against the always despised Billy Spears, man. Fans love to hate Billy. Then Charlie Cook was going to be facing Iron Mike Masters, the new guy from New York, really good-looking kid. Then Brad Armstrong had moved up the card at this point to the third match in his third week in as a pro. He's up to the third match already, and he had not been beat, which was truly amazing. In your first 50 matches, you were lucky to win five, and he hadn't been beat yet. And this time he's going to be facing a real veteran. He's going to be facing Big C number two, which was Jerry Brown, who was a great, great wrestler. So the next match was for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. Former champion Jerry Stubbs, who defeated Ricky Gibson last week in a loser leaves Southeastern match, was back to try and regain his belt from the new champion, Norvell Austin. Robert, who was still upset about my having to leave Southeastern 2 weeks earlier, was back trying to beat the wrestler that eliminated me and trying to regain his the South, who had regained his Southeastern title from me, the Mongolian Stomper. He was managed by the Big C, who was now Don Carson. And this was a no disqualification match. Then there was one more match, Southeastern Tag Championship match, Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc, the champions defending against the new team of Ron Bass and the Super Pro. And they were going to be managed by Don Carson.
Man, Don Carson was staying pretty busy, wasn't he? All right, so before we take our break, Ron, the two loser leaves Southeastern matches last week between Jerry Stubbs, Ricky Gibson, Plowboy Frazier, and Don Carson, and the one you lost the week before to the Stomper, have kind of been thinking about those, especially after what Rob, Bob, and Joe LeDuc said last week at the end of the TV show about what those matches do to wrestlers and their families, as you can imagine. So at this point, you had been out of action for 2 weeks. So how did you feel about those loser leave matches? Because once it's done, it's like it's done. If that person shows back up, your credibility is gone.
Yes. And, that's a really good question, Dave. And my situation was a very different from most wrestlers. I had just lost a loser leave. But since I was a part of the Southeastern ownership, I wasn't nearly as affected by losing that match as most wrestlers were. When I lost, I could still make a living and stay right where I was because I lived down there. I was going to get money from my promotion there as part of the company. So, but for other wrestlers that had to leave, if they wanted to make a living in the same business, they had to go. And it was very difficult. Not only them, but for their families as well, man, to make those moves and not be aware of when it's going to be coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So in no way, man, can I forget what it did also to the fans. And when I lost this last loser leave match 2 weeks earlier, in every city where I had lost the match, there was literally hundreds of fans waiting outside the dressing room to say goodbye after I took a shower. And, 30, 40 minutes after the match, I came out of the dressing room and there would be this mob of people and a lot of them crying, I cried a few tears myself, So for the first time, it kind of affected me. This loser leave situation, and So I made sure to acknowledge every single one of those people. They treated me like I was a family member, going away for a long time, like, you know, and you know, great question, because those matches really, really were hard on wrestlers. So it was also a tough decision for bookers and owners as well. And the last 5 weeks before this studcast, not including my loss, Tony Charles, Sweet Brown Sugar, Plowboy's Buddy Floyd, Plowboy himself, and now Ricky Gibson, they were all gone. And sometimes professional wrestling was a really cruel way to make a living.
Well, it's a good way to put it. I never really thought about loser leaves matches exactly that way. But all right, let's do our break. And when we return, we're going to find out who and what was on the next TV show. That is coming up as this Studcast continues. Okay, Studcast fans, it's getting that time of year. Not only Christmas time, but Brutus time. Ron's best-selling book, Brutus, makes a wonderful Christmas present. It's one of the best-selling thriller novels in history. It has a 4.5 rating with more than 70 reviews on Amazon. Many readers describe it as the next Jaws. The only place you can get it, autographed to the buyer with a special note attached, is on Ron's website, tnstud.com. Click Stud Store. It's only $29.99 and the shipping is absolutely free. Give your loved one, or maybe yourself, the story of a lifetime. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back. This is episode number 375 of the Studcast. This one is called Brad Breaking In, Stubbs Snubbed. Okay, so this was the first week in November of 1980. And if I remember correctly, this entire month was a TV rating period. So how did the TV show begin? Set it up for us, Stud.
It opened up with a video in progress, which we'd been doing quite a bit of lately. I thought it was a great way for the show to open up with a wrestling match already the very first thing the fans see.
Yeah.
This video that was in progress was of Norvell Austin beating one of the very competent Oates brothers, who were two brothers out of Columbus, Georgia, really good wrestlers themselves. It was Norvell's first title defense. And so basically they got to see about 2 minutes of a great ending to the match, with Norvell Austin winning with one of those diving headbutts that he used, man, which were really devastating. Norvell had been known for that particular move. I don't know, thank you, I ever saw anybody else do that. The TV studio audience gave him a big hand. So they got, because he was right there at the set. As soon as they came out of that video, there sits Norvell between Les Thatcher and Charlie Pratt. Mm-hmm. And you know, he already got a big hand from seeing what happened on the tape. And then mm-hmm. There he is live and in person. So they both congratulated Norvell for the win, Charlie and Les. And they announced that this month, the month of November, as you just mentioned, for the entire month was a rating period. And there were going to be championship matches on every one of them. And that Norvell was going to be defending his belt again right here on television on the last match on this show. And obviously that got another big pop. So as Norvell was leaving the set, the TV audience got another treat. Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc came to the set. And they had their Southeastern tag belts with them, and they watched the TV tag match from the week before, where Joe LeDuc took Big C's mask off, revealing him to be really Don Carson, and giving the studio audience another opportunity to get a big roar by watching that mask come off of Don Carson. And then Carson was watching, in the dressing room, which all the wrestlers did. They had a monitor in the dressing room. And I guess he couldn't take any more. So he trotted out his new team, man. Ron Bass and the Super Pro is going to be their first TV match of the day, the first TV match on the show. And Bass and the Super Pro were going to be up against Armstrong and LeDuc as challengers for the tag team belts in this upcoming week. So after introduction of both teams, the first live TV match was underway, and Bob Armstrong and Joe LaDuke stayed at the set with Charlie and Les. So, and both Charlie and Les reminded the fans that this Ron Bass and Super Pro combination wasn't really a new one, and that they had been tag team partners for a month, which was in the past, back to August. It was about 2 months earlier. They were tag team champions, but he was Randy Rose at that point. Randy Rose was with Ron Bass. Now it's the Super Pro. And the way that Rose became the Super Pro is Rose got beat in the pole match by Bob Armstrong during that month of August. And he had supposed to leave the territory. He did, gone for 1 week. And then he shows back up as the Masked Super Pro. So it was a good thing that Carson was at ringside and he couldn't hear any of this, because he would have been going crazy knowing that his team was being totally debunked, man, right before they even won their first match. And when they did, just minutes later, it was with great malice. Bass used that wicked Texas Stampede, ran across the ring with a guy on his shoulder and threw that 300-plus pounds on top of him, and Super Pro shot his guy into the ropes and caught him with one of those clotheslines, about took his head off.
Wow, I mean, that's a great way to open a TV show when you're ready to get it going. I mean, that's the method right there. All right, not one but two videos of matches right before Charlie and Les made a fool out of the manager of the winning team in the first TV match. All right, so who was next?
Okay, Brad, and boy, a young man, making his first ever TV appearance after only his third match, really. And he was still, at this point, undefeated. Like I said, that just didn't happen for new guys. The studio fans absolutely loved him from the very start. And they went crazy, man, because he captured his first win on TV. He did a Russian leg sweep that was so beautiful. Brad was a fantastic wrestler. Mm-hmm. All his life, he was a fantastic wrestler. And he had learned how to do a Russian leg sweep with a flyover and cover, man. I had never seen that move done with that flyover and cover part of it. He had invented his own move, in a way, at three matches in.
I swear, as you're talking about it, I think I saw that TV show. I remember Brad. He was a star. I mean, from the moment fans laid eyes on him, you could just tell when you were watching him on TV, this guy is going to be big time. I had never seen that move before and would probably never forget it. He used it in a lot of his early matches, as I recall. All right, so set us up now as we go to the personality profile.
Well, there were three wrestlers in this one. There was two, Rob, and was with Charlie Platt in the smaller studio. And the Mongolian Stomper and Don Carson were in the main studio on the profile set with Les Thatcher. Both Carson and Les were seated in the profile chairs. Mongolian Stomper was standing behind Carson. He had on his Southeastern belt, and he also had that truck shock, man. And he was wearing that thing out. Don Carson started things off with a bang. He let Les know that he was in the dressing room. And he heard what they said, right? And he was extremely unhappy, you know, they said something like that. So Les and Charlie, you know, he said to Les and Charlie, being in that first match of the day, it concerned his team, Ron Bass and the Super Pro. How could you guys, being professionals as you're supposed to be, say stuff like that? So he was still as fired up on this profile as he had been on the last show's profile. And on the last show's profile, remember, he got carried off on the shoulders of all his men back to the dressing room. So he told Les he had a video he wanted to show of a recent match. You know, he said where someone lost to Loser Lee and was never coming back, probably never going to be coming back to Southeastern Wrestling ever. So Les asked, you know, Les wasn't aware of what was going on. And he asked him, well, what video are you talking about? And who's on it? Because, you know, he told him, he said, it's my job and Charlie's job to control what's seen here on each show, Don. And there's no video scheduled in this personality profile on the format. So Carson said, as Don would normally do, you know, oh, don't worry about it. It's been cleared. It's already been shown, in fact, he said. So Les was hesitant, but he finally told the director to roll whatever the video was. Well, it happened to be the loser leave match with me from 2 weeks earlier. It was very short. And it started with a ring full of wrestlers. But then there was a real clear shot of Big C, who everybody knew was Carson at this point, hitting me in the back of the head with his loaded glove, Stomper covering me for what was an extremely controversial win, for sure. Les shouted to the director to stop the video. But Carson had already accomplished what he wanted. He didn't care at this point. He just wanted to show me getting beat again. So both he and the Mongolian Stomper started laughing insanely, man. It's like they'd had a plan and it worked. They were enjoying it. And so Carson started screaming to Robert, who was in the other studio waiting to be talked to with Charlie Platt. And he screamed to Robert that, you got this. Get ready, boy. This is what's coming. You're going to get this, too. You're going to soon be gone yourself. So let's try to get control, but it wasn't much way you could control Carson and the Stomper, and they were still laughing, and they were already walking back to the dressing room when Les is trying to let him know how unhappy he was with what had just happened. So all Les could do at that point was throw the interview to Charlie and Rob, who was in the other studio. And Rob was very upset that Carson had managed to get that piece of video on the show again. Charlie apologized, but the damage obviously had already been done, as far as Rob was concerned anyway. So he told Charlie, you know, that he hated that video. And he said, I'd like for you guys to destroy that piece of video, if y'all don't mind, you know. And he said, you know, it's one thing, you know, for my brother to lose such an important match, but to lose it like that was in no way fair in any sense, what happened to him. And they said, my brother's home and he's healthy now, but he's probably looking for somewhere else in the country to wrestle when he should be right here in Southeastern wrestling today. Boy, and he got a big pop from the studio with the crowd with that. They felt the same way, I think. And so I was watching from my home in Pensacola, and I was proud of Rob for standing up for me. He told Charlie and all of them watching that he had one goal now, to get that Southeastern belt and to see not just the Stomper gone from Southeastern, but Don Carson with him. And the profile ended with the studio audience cheering my brother on.
Okay, I mean, a very difficult personality profile. It showed the love you guys had for each other as brothers, obviously. So who was in the next TV match?
Oh, my brother. And what an ovation he got from the studio crowd, man. They were really glad to see him also wrestling. You could see the determination he had, man, in this match. It was a short match, and he ended up beating his opponent with a fuller leg lock. But you could see that he was really bearing down, and he was really upset with the fact that I was no longer able to wrestle in Southeastern.
Yeah, I understand that. All right, so my guess is now you're probably pretty close, or it's time for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, the first title match of the November 1980 TV ratings month, right?
Yep, we're going to have title match every week for the entire month of November. We try to do that all the time. That's how we got the great ratings, I think, is we really took advantage of these rating periods. So good guess, Dave. But before it started, Jerry Stubbs, being his obnoxious self, pushed his way onto the set with Les and Charlie. Wasn't supposed to be there. And then he forced him to show a piece of his loser leaves match from the week before against Ricky Gibson. You know, and they didn't, they hesitated to do it, but he had already been up, talked to the director, he left it up there. So they didn't watch very much of it. They didn't endure much of it. And they called for it to end. To end. They clearly snubbed Stubbs, man. But not before Jerry got to brag about how he sent a fan favorite, a Pensacola boy, mm-hmm. out of this part of the country. And then he practically begged him to allow him to stay at the set and make some comments about this upcoming his upcoming opponent and his return match for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Norvell Austin. I want to be here, and I think I should be here at the desk, and I got a lot of things to say about this guy. So, you know, and again, Charlie and Les, being nice hosts, they relented, and Stubbs stayed. So the studio crowd was fired up for this match, man, especially when Norvell's opponent was introduced. When Billy Spears comes to the ring, I mean, fans were this, wow. they just were on Billy horrible always. And and Billy, though, actually did a very good job in this match against Norvell. And Stubbs had nothing good to say, obviously, about the match, and certainly not Norvell. And all he spent his time on predicting the win that was coming up here for back to get my belt back. And I'm going to get it back easily, he kept saying. So when Norvell got ready to finish Spears off, he hit him, man, with that diving headbutt. As Spears came flying off the ropes and he covered him. And Stubbs made his move. Found out why Stubbs wanted to be there so badly. He shot up in the ring, and about the time Norvell had his back turned, getting his hand raised by the referee, Stubbs nailed him in the back of the head. And then this studio popped with the win until they saw Stubbs hit Norvell from behind. Then Stubbs threw him out of the ring, and he went out after him. He got him. He ran him head first into the ring post. And then he hammered him with punches, man, all of them to the head until he was pretty bloody. Norvell was pretty bloody at that point. Brad Armstrong, Charlie Cook, they came out of the dressing room, and they chased Stubbs back into the other dressing room.
So Jerry Stubbs was stirring it up. I mean, what a spectacle he made of himself during that entire last match segment. All right, it had been a while since something like that had happened on the end of the TV show, was it the end of the TV show?
Well, it was close to the end, man, but the show actually closed out with an announcement that the next week, the Mongolian Stomper, who was the television champion, mm-hmm. Was going to be defending his TV trophy live on the show. So we got in a plug for the next championship match the following week.
Cool. All right, another great TV show. All right, so let's talk about the results of this card and TV show in the arenas that week. How'd you guys do?
Roy Lee got a win over Billy Spears. Charlie Cook beat Iron Mike Masters. Brad Armstrong, man, continued his rookie winning streak with a very impressive win over the veteran, Big C2, Jerry Brown, man. And he got him with that same Russian leg sweep that he had mastered, man. he was off to a good start. He had a great finish hold, and he was kicking butt for a young guy. In the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match, both men were disqualified for hitting the referee, and Norvell Austin got to keep his belt. And then the disqualification Southeastern Championship match between Robert and the champion Mongolian Stomper, both men got counted out on the floor as they fought back to the Stomper's dressing room with Don Carson right in there doing whatever he could to get Rob's attention. But as always, he was the first guy to disappear into the dressing room. He didn't stay too long.
Right.
So Don Carson Lee, you know, had finally made something happen, though, in this night. For his men, at least, in the last match of the night, which was for the Southeastern Tag Championship, champions Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc, they lost their belts. Carson was able to get behind the referee's back and catch Joe LeDuc not watching, and he loaded his glove and knocked Joe out, man. And Ron Bass covered the Lumberjack for the title win.
Definitely sounds like another wild night. But with so many loser leaves matches lately and stars gone, you only had five matches on this card. How did you do at the box office?
Well, Montgomery dropped. I was expecting it to be a pretty substantial drop, to be honest with you. But Montgomery dropped only about 500 fans. We went from 4,500 down to 4,000. Dothan was about the same as Montgomery. It dropped about 500 fans. It had 4,800. It went down to 43. And Mobile was Mobile, man. It was steady. I mean, and it still sold out with its 6,000. So we were down a little from the crowds that we'd been having, obviously, for some time at this point, but not as much as I anticipated that we might be down. The loser leaves matches becoming a little problem because more losers were baby faces than heels. So some of our baby faces were gone, and some of our new incoming wrestlers were still finishing up in other territories. We had already talked to guys. We had new guys coming, but we didn't have as many baby faces as we had before, so we couldn't have as many matches. It was harder to have as many matches, at least. So it was nothing to be greatly concerned about, though, because the big tournament in Birmingham the next week was bringing in both Luthes and Les Thornton for an entire week.
Wow, that's cool, Stud. All right, so that was, two of the biggest names in the sport at the time, and they were going to be in the territory for a week, you say. So instead of a disaster, that to me, that sounds like a brilliant bit of booking.
We were lucky. I mean, it worked out good for us, Dave. Luthes, who had been hearing about us and got my phone number from the president of the NWA, Sam Muchnick, Lou called me up and he said he wanted to come down and see what we were doing down there. That we were getting so much attention from. And he asked me, he said, could you book me for a week? I'd like to stay there for a week with you. So he said, anytime you need me, right? So some things just worked out right. So I said, we need you, right? You call it a great time. You're come on in. So then Les Thornton had done so well recently with us during those recent triple world title cards that we were having. He called about the same time as Lou did, and he asked when he could come back again. And he was blown away, with our junior heavyweight talent. He said, you got the best junior heavyweight wrestlers in the country, Ron. And I'd love to come back. And so I booked him same week as Thez against a couple of those guys that he wanted to wrestle. And so it turned out to be a real break for us. Instead of a possible disaster where we could have lost our momentum, Thez and Thornton not only gave us real impact for our first Birmingham card by having a former NWA world champion and the present world junior heavyweight champion entering a tournament for the Alabama championship belt, we were also able to add them to the towns that didn't have these tournaments and add those two stars to the card. So we were going to have another huge week, it looked like.
Wow, you guys never fail to surprise me with your luck. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, booking's never easy, man. And anything but luck, really. But that was a lucky little deal, man. We got those calls.
All right. Speaking of luck, I have good news. We have time for another learning tree question this week. Let's get to it. This one is about someone you have talked about in this studcast, as a matter of fact. The question comes from a gentleman named Lawrence Dundee. He is in Perth, Australia. He says, quote, I love your pod. And notice that Brad Armstrong, who we see on TV here many times years ago, according to your weekly recounting, wrestled his first match and then not another for many weeks. Why do you suppose that happened? I'm curious about that myself, Stud.
That's a pretty darn good question, Matt. I got to say, first of all, before I get to answering your question, Mr. Dundee, I love your country, for one thing. And I wonder, are you related by any chance to Bill Dundee, the Aussie that lives up there in Memphis, the great friend of mine, man? I'm curious about that. And that's a very interesting question you have there. About Brad's career. And Brad's career was not like any normal young wrestler, I can tell you that. He grew up, man, the son of one of the greatest wrestlers that ever lived, Bob Armstrong. And Bob was the type that never settled for normal in anything. He didn't want to be normal. And especially when it came to his son that was going to become a wrestler, and he was going to be followed by three more sons. So, Brad was in the position of being the first, and he was going to have it the hardest, basically, for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so I know that Bob worked with Brad as only a father that cared deeply about his son could. I watched a lot of their workouts, and Bob pushed him big time. And he not only wanted the best for Brad, but he expected the best from Brad. And then he may have seen some things in Brad's first match that, in his opinion, it was just not good enough for Bob, And I think that may be why he probably kept Brad out of the spotlight again until he was satisfied with everything Brad was doing. In that first match or two that he saw, that first match, actually, he didn't even have a second match until just this past week. So it's like 7 weeks there that he wrestled one match, and he was gone for 7 weeks before Bob allowed him to be put back on the card again.
Yeah.
So knowing Brad as I did, I know he was chomping at the bit to get back in that ring like a little yearling horse, man. And I know that when Bob finally turned him loose and allowed him to get back in the ring, I don't think Brad ever missed a single week after that in his entire first year as a wrestler.
Wow.
I mean, that boy was committed, and he loved it. So I don't know how familiar you are, Mr. Dundee, with Brad's career, but in his first year in the ring, Brad won the National Wrestling Alliance Rookie of the Year Award. He was chosen by the promoters and by fans as the best first-year wrestler in the sport. And actually, this is amazing, it was the same honor bestowed upon his dad in 1965.
How about that?
Yeah. Bob was also selected as the NWA Rookie of the Year in 1965. They were, in fact, the only father and son to ever both become Rookies of the Year in wrestling. So I hope I properly answered your question, Mr.
Dundee.
Mr. Dundee.
Yep.
Mr. Dundee. And thanks for asking.
Yeah, you were asking about Bill Dundee. I was thinking about Crocodile Dundee. Also from Australia, from the movie.
There's a lot of Dundees in Australia. Yeah.
All right, I want to dig a little bit deeper just for a second. So Bob obviously is the one who meticulously trained Brad. So you think it was as simple as something? Bob saw something in Brad in that first match. He said, "No, son, you're not ready." And he pulled him because you said it was probably another 7 weeks or so. So he thought, you need more training on XYZ. What do you think it was? You have any idea?
I don't know what it was in particular, but I know he was unhappy with it, obviously. He didn't see what he wanted to see in Brad's first match. And Bob was, like I said, normal. Just a normal match was not what Bob was interested in.
Yeah.
He wanted Brad to be a star from the very beginning. And by golly, he made it happen. Brad was a star from his very, well, let's say his first match wasn't in Bob's eyes. In Bob's eyes, a star. But by gosh, in all the rest of them that I ever saw him in, he was darn sure a star.
Well, obviously, he took Brad out after that first match, took him back to the, I mean, surely Bob and the family had some sort of wrestling ring set up at home in a barn, in a something like that.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. In the backyard.
Yeah. Okay. So
and it wasn't just Brad. It wasn't just Brad at the time. You know, Brad was the focus because he was a couple of years older than Scott. Yeah.
First in line to get into a real ring.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah. They had a ring in their backyard, and just as my brother and I did when I was a junior and senior in high school.
Yeah.
We had a ring in our backyard too.
Wow.
And we were in it every day.
Yeah, you had a great coach, and Brad obviously had one of the greatest coaches ever. That was a lot of fun, that learning tree question. A terrific answer, and appreciate you letting me dig a little bit deeper on that. All right, next week's show, where are we going to be riding next week, Stud?
We're going to focus, man, totally next week on that first event in the biggest city in Southeastern history. For us, it was a long-awaited event. We bought this territory back in May, and now we're in November, and we're going to have our very first event. So for the owners, this was really something special. It actually was for the entire crew. Every one of these wrestlers knew the history of Birmingham, how big it was. They were chomping at the bit to get there, too. So we're going to cover that for the fans. And we're going to cover that from the time the fans started entering the building mm-hmm. until that 250-mile trip back home to Pensacola from Birmingham after it was all over in great detail. I think fans are going to be amazed at all that occurred on this first event. And so don't miss it, man. It's going to be special.
Oh, no doubt about it. I tell you what, this has been another great Studcast, ending with a wonderful learning tree answer that I think you really nailed. I love these learning tree questions and what listeners come up with and the angle that you take when you get ready to answer these. So it's always so much fun. All right. And we've covered such a great period of time in this one when wrestling was truly wrestling. And it sounds like the next Studcast is going to be something really special too for the fans to enjoy. No doubt about it. We hope you can join us next week. All right. On Facebook, it's simple to get up with Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. And as we said, there's a little activity, some sort of problem on Ron's Facebook. As soon as we're done with today's Studcast, he's going to be trying to get that situation fixed, whether it's the computer or a virus or something. So we're going to try to get that straightened out for you. On Twitter or X, no problems there. You can contact Ron at any time. He's Ron Fuller Welch. Follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. This Studcast is going to be there. Every Studcast ever done is there. The Stud Store, where you can get 43 Super Studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the best-selling Lion novel called Brutus. You can get it personally autographed to you or anyone in the family as we close in on the holidays. And subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 450 total videos, the last 153 Studcasts, Ask the Stud shows, and Short Rides with the Stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories with worldwide stars, Studcast archive stories, Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. It's YouTube, Southeastern Rewind. It truly is the best deal in wrestling. All right, any final comments from you this week, Ron?
Yeah, just, man, I want to thank all our listeners out there for joining us again today, and hope you join us next week, man. It's truly going to be a special Studcast, the next one. Please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening as well. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers with an O, 955, and on Twitter called X also, Dave_Doin. On Instagram, it's instagram.com/DavidSummersProductions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.